Hello, and welcome to today's episode of the Beautiful Business Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Baldwin, and today I'm going to be joined by Amelia Wrighton, co-founder and CEO of the charity Suicide & Co. Suicide & Co. was set up by Amelia and her friend Emma in 2020, just before COVID started, with a view to helping people bereaved by suicide. Today, Suicide & Co. employs 16 people and a team of counsellors. In the last month alone, they've delivered 650 hours of counselling sessions. I've been working closely with Amelia for the last 4 years, and I've seen firsthand her passion, resilience, and phenomenal ambition. Today, we're going to talk about Amelia's inspiring story. We're going to talk about what it's like scaling an organisation within the charity sector, and you get an insight into the ambition that's taken this charity from a pipe dream into one of the most disruptive, influential charities in their sector.
So before we begin, we should share a trigger warning. This episode includes discussion of suicide and bereavement, which some listeners may find distressing. Please take care while listening and reach out for support if you need it.
Welcome to the Beautiful Business Podcast from The Wow Company. If you're growing a UK business with a team of 8 to 80 people, you're in the right place. Every fortnight, we share honest conversations with brilliant business minds, exploring the realities of leadership, the challenges that come with growth, and the practical ideas that make a real difference. From purpose to profit, people to process, this is your space for fresh thinking and down-to-earth inspiration.
Amelia, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So let's begin at the beginning. First question we ask all of our guests, and as you're an avid Beautiful Business Podcast listener, you all know what's coming. Tell me one thing about you that maybe I don't already know, or certainly our followers don't know.
I do. I am an avid listener of the podcast. It's very exciting to be here. My one thing that I don't think people would know about me unless they had serious stalking skills would be my previous very semi-professional, or actually not professional at all, time in musical theatre, and probably the proudest moment of my life, maybe even including Suicide & Co, was performing the role of Bert in Mary Poppins whilst I was at school. 7 solos, still incredibly proud.
No way. So I feel like this could be like the first like musical Beautiful Business episode we've got. Can you still channel your inner Bert at all? Or?
I can. I'm very up for breaking into song throughout the episode.
A little bit of Chim Chimney.
The favourite was probably Step in Time. It is an 8-minute dance number where you are having to sing. And it was a school musical, so there were, you know, something like 70 of us on the stage going Step in Time, Step in Time, Step in Time. And it was honestly, I can see you fully laughing, but it was honestly a pretty, you know, big achievement to keep going for, you know, 8 minutes on stage.
And did you ever consider a career in musical theatre?
I did think I was going to go to musical theatre school. I think if I ever have kids, I'll be that mum that's involved in like the school productions and being like, what? You need a backup performer? Oh, don't mind me. That's probably going to be me. No, I think those times have gone. Although any time I can integrate musicals into, you know, an event at Suicide & Co, believe me, I am making it happen.
You're all over it. Okay. Let's start with your story. How on earth did you end up as the CEO of this fantastic charity?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, considering we were just talking about when I was 19, that's kind of where it all really starts. Very sadly, when I was in my first year of university, I lost my mum to suicide. And that kind of world-shattering event is probably the core reason of why I'm working in this now. But the journey to it had a lot of turns and it was not a straight path, because my experience of navigating suicide loss was very challenging. I wasn't signposted to any support. I found that conversations with friends and families was really stigmatized and just wasn't really happening. And at core level, I didn't feel like I deserved support for suicide-related grief. I thought grief was something we were supposed to navigate just in life. And so what that led to was me suppressing a lot of the emotions I was having. And that in turn, that suppression kind of deteriorated my own mental health and even had physical manifestations. I got alopecia, lost a lot of the back of my hair. And I essentially finally got into counseling. That was a real change moment for me. I realized I was going to be able to heal, but I didn't necessarily talk about it broadly. I didn't, you know, really lean into the space until 8 years after my mum died, when I met my now co-founder, Emma, and we had a conversation that changed everything. She had lost a parent to suicide a year before me. We have completely different upbringings, completely different family situations, and our experience of suicide loss had loads of commonalities. And that made me think, how have I been feeling I'm the only one when there's somebody here? Maybe there are more. And in 2019, we did a big research study. My kind of commercial background and background in sales and business and more of the commercial world led me to really check if there was a gap. Like, is there a gap for an organization? What is it? What should it do? And then we used all the different data points we found at that time to identify a huge gap in suicide bereavement, specifically in providing professional support. So in our terms, counseling. And when I couldn't find a reason not to do it, we started it in July 2020. And then I juggled it for about 2.5 years of my day job, thinking this will be a nice project to give me a bit of purpose, but I'll continue to sell advertising and make a good salary and do that over there. And then the purpose of what we were doing just completely engulfed me and changed my life. And 2.5 years into doing the charity, you know, I then moved in full time. And now I'm running a full proper organization, which is unbelievable.
A proper organization with staff and commitments and offices and everything. A couple of bits to pick up on there. You talked about the gap to see if there was a gap. Can you just talk briefly about what the gap was that you established?
Yeah, so we were looking around the full topic of suicide. So we were looking at suicide prevention and suicide bereavement. And what we found was that there was a lot of suicide prevention charities that existed all over the country, local ones, national ones. And really importantly, there were options. So there's helplines, there's text services, there's in-person support. What then didn't exist as on suicide bereavement. There was one charity that had been going for like 30 years that does peer-to-peer, who we're friendly with now. And that was it. And then you had a government that wasn't set up at all to deal with suicide bereavement in comparison to other modes of death, even things like murder that have had referral pathways in place for decades with victim support from emergency services. It was just the space that you were like, how is nothing happening here? And general bereavement services as well that were existing didn't have specialist trainings in them. There were some pockets of excellence on a local level. There were things like there's a brilliant service in Liverpool, but they were local and it was a complete postcode lottery. And yet there were 36,000 people being newly bereaved by suicide every single year. And that's only if you take a factor of 6 people being directly impacted per person who dies. It's not even fully representative in most cases. That was the gap. That was like, what are these people supposed to be doing? What am I supposed to be doing? Just suffering in silence?
Yeah, so all the money, all the resource, all the grants, all the government support goes to suicide prevention, right? And very little to suicide bereavement support.
I mean, I also, just to clarify, I would never say there was enough money going into suicide prevention or mental health. I mean, at the moment, I'm currently reading a grant book. I'm like a complete dork who reads an entire dictionary when the grant book comes out. I read it cover to cover. And it is pretty amazing to see, like, mental health is such an underfunded area. And then within that, suicide prevention is a hugely underfunded area. And then underneath that, suicide bereavement. I mean, if you think about the fact that organizations like Samaritans are probably on 20, 30 million, Mind would probably on 200 million. But if you compared that to the physical health sector, like cancer or like animal welfare, you're going to be talking nowhere near comparison.
Lots of people do this, right? And they have a charity set up in, like, quite often in a loved one's memory. I've been working with you for 4 out of the 5 years you've been going right from the start. You had a much bigger ambition for this. And Where did that ambition come from?
The ambition really came from the fact that the gap that we'd identified was in service delivery. We didn't feel like we needed to be campaigning or we needed to be doing awareness or training. We felt like we needed to get access, like actual services, into the hands of those bereaved by suicide. Because another thing that we learned was that the average cost of counselling is £60 a session, and that's simply inaccessible. So our first ever thing that we wanted to do was build a counselling service that is still the same offering today. We offer 12 sessions of counselling to anyone who's lost a loved one to suicide over the age of 18, and that's completely free of charge using qualified counsellors who we pay with an assessment process up front and a matching matrix. Like, that is so, like, you know, bracket gold standard. It's unbelievable. Like, that, you don't even get that in the NHS. So I think the ambition came from, what do we think is going to really have an impact on people's lives? What do we think is going to work? Realistically, 3 to 4 months worth of one-to-one support is hugely impactful, with some, you know, caveats around, are you in the right place for it? And as soon as we launched that, with no awareness, our demand was going up and up and up and up. And to give you an example, last month in September 2025, you know, we had 121 people apply for counselling. And, you know, this is all going organically. We're not doing any outreach. We've now had over 3,000 people in total apply. So the ambition has always been led from day one, from providing services. And then since those have been live, we have had to run behind our tails to catch up with demand. I often say, because we started to do the charity before COVID, but then we launched it after COVID, because obviously we had no idea if it was coming. I think I thought charity was like, have a party, do a bake sale, get people together. I hadn't really had another version of what that was. And yet for us, launching a charity was turning on a website and not doing a physical event for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And also the fact that we have to fundraise so much, like this year we're trying to raise 1.2 million, is meaning that we're having to really be innovative of how we do that.
But your fundraising is broad. I'm not wearing it today, but I've got like one of the jumpers. I've got a couple of t-shirts. So there's a whole range of like merchandise. There's notebooks. There's events. There's marathons. You've like really taken a new approach to fundraising, right?
Totally. And I mean, like, we are completely funded by the public and grant funders and foundations. We've got no government funding. And when I say we value our £3 a month monthly donor as much as we value our 80 grand donation that recurs 3 years in a row from a grant funder, that's the truth. You know, like, every place that we can get somebody to come behind our mission and stand with us means the most. And we have to be incredibly diverse to keep fundraising as much as we can in the climate that we can. But we also do, I think, in a way that tries to provide real value. You mentioned the sweatshirts. We do incredible events. Like, in this market, people want value for money as well. And I know that seems weird, because it shouldn't be like that with philanthropy. But with a young generation of philanthropists, with, you know, a cost of living crisis, it helps to feel like you've donated for a great experience, or you've donated and you've got a product in return, you know, or you've gone to an event. Something that really kind of feels like you've had that connection with where your funds are going, I think has a huge place nowadays.
One of the many clever things you've done is to create a whole brand around it that people want to be. So I'll wear my Suicide & Co jumper out in public, not because I'm a fan, but because it looks good. And your events are out of this world.
We're doing our next sort of like gala type event at the Natural History Museum with 450 people. We've got McLaren as a headline partner and loads of other partners on board. We've got a celebrity talent that I can't announce as our host, but, you know, we have poured everything into that event to make details that will just add a personalized touch. You know, in the same way as with our clients, we are so focused on a person-centered model, right? Like, the reality is suicide loss completely is overwhelming and bizarre, and everybody's experience is totally unique. So we need to have a team that can actually react to that. It's not a one size fits all. We are very much like that with our fundraising. We want people to be able to find a way to give that fits with them. And we want people that come to our events to be made to feel like they are welcomed by us and in our community and along with us on this amazing journey that we are on.
All of this fundraising last month, Suicide & Co provided 650 hours of counselling. Is that right, last month?
Mm.
Wow.
As well as 200 hours of emotional support on top of that and our app and all of our supplementary services. But that was our biggest month to date. But those types of numbers are so motivating for us, 100%.
Like how many hours do you think that Suicide & Co will need to provide in the future?
Interestingly, we're modelling that at the moment. So, I mean, the number I mentioned earlier around the fact that there are 36,000 people newly bereaved each year, it is our kind of long-term holistic vision that every person in this country that's bereaved by suicide is connected with support in their first week of loss. Now, support could be our app, it could be our emotional practical support service, it could be counselling, could be reading a leaflet or following us on social media. But the first week angle is really what we are trying to get to. We're trying to create real systemic change where, you know, people are at that first moment of devastation, left with a feeling that there's someone that can keep them company on this journey and that there is support available should they need it as and when they're ready. That, for me, it becomes a really big sort of North Star. We haven't officially actually said that in places, but we're pretty much going in that direction. In terms of the scale of how we get to that is for us to build over the next 10 years. You know, we've got a view of what we think should happen. It's trying to define what our role is within that. Now, if you think about the fact that last year we supported 1,337 people in one-to-one care, and this year we'll probably support just under 2,000, I think, with our current growth metrics. You know, that's a lot of people, but it's also a big gap from 36,000.
There's still a long way to go, right?
It's a long way to go. And I feel like we've known that since the start. And that's one thing I think is quite unique about the journey is when we were building it, we were building for scale. So we were building as a national service, you know, our model being empowered by technology. We knew that we wanted to have something like an app to be able to kind of have that broader democratization of support. But the constant balance between our value set, which is in human connection, professional support, really getting that to individuals and scale, they don't really go hand in hand. Even if I look at the private sector, there are so few businesses I can model off of. It's unbelievable because the only real thing you'd be looking at is an EAP, and every business I speak to says, oh yeah, well, no one uses our EAP. And then you go to an EAP and they think, oh gosh, you know, we're brilliant and we're doing all of this new on-demand stuff. Like it's a really hard space to get right. But I think the thing that's really exciting about us is because we're so specific and we're building a specialism and have a specialism in suicide bereavement, I have more faith in us being able to just keep growing step by step and taking it as we go.
Yeah, so something you said there, like really interesting, I want to pick up on was like from the beginning, you wanted to build a national service. You wanted it to be tech-based. So there's ambition and then there's ambition. You know, you talk about helping nearly 2,000 people this year. Scale of the problem is, well, at least 36,000 people per year. That's not to talk about the backlog of people who haven't been helped in previous years. In you personally, what is it that fuels that ambition?
In me personally, I think it has become the wait list. So I think originally the fuel to get to that was the big scary 36,000 number and just really trying to understand that if those are 36,000 people that felt like how I felt back in 2011, I want to try and change it for them really badly. And I can put myself in those shoes because of my lived experience. But that is so holistic. And I don't know what 36,000 people even looks like. I can't really get my head around that. I can't get my head around 1,337. I always say, if I think I saw all of our clients from last year in one room, I just wouldn't be able to wrap my head around it. What I can see, what I can feel is our wait list. And our wait list builds every day. And it's currently sitting about 2.5 months. It takes us to get somebody into counseling And I'm not happy with that, and not happy with people having to wait when they take a brave step to say, hey, I need counselling. I'm going to apply. I want help. I don't like the fact that we have to wait 2.5 months to get them into care. Now, that is something that lots of my charity colleagues would be really proud of. We're always complimented on the fact that our waitlist is only 2.5 months, but we're working in such a broken system. It sometimes you can get the wrong glasses on and you think good is good. But if you go back to what you were like before, is good good? So my ambition for growth, everything is always fueled by demand. It stays the same. I think some people we meet think we're just wanting to grow at all costs and let's do another gala at the Natural, you know, let's go bigger. And it's just not the case. I don't want to lessen the impact of our service and have a longer waitlist. We just won't let it happen.
You'd like come into the not-for-profit sector, charity sector, and you're clearly doing things very, very differently by anyone's standards. You're doing things very differently. And whether you call that being innovative or disruptive, my take on it is that you brought in techniques, strategies, tactics from the corporate world and then employed it in a charity. Basically, what challenges have you had in doing that?
I think there have been quite a lot. And I actually think some of the challenges are coming to fruition the bigger we get. I think I have tried to always apply like a commercial brain to the organization. I would say that kind of falls under three buckets. One, you still need a really strong brand. I used to go on charity websites when we did our research and be like, this website looks like, you know, it's off the shelf or it's depressing or it's crap to use. And that's making me feel worse being here. Like, just because I'm coming on a charity website doesn't mean I shouldn't have like an amazing brand experience. I think the second one would be around like clients, looking at your clients as clients and your service as like customer service and really trying to think about every aspect of what you're doing as, you know, working with clients or customers or whatever that language is. And then I think the third has been trying to realize that your operational efficiency is the more that we can make that efficient and invest in that, the more that we can spend the money on getting humans, connecting with humans for 50 minutes to talk about suicide loss. Like, the more that comes back to that. I would say that a lot of like the principles that we set up at the start were easy to do. They were easy to kind of inspire people. They were easy to kind of have as a structure. I think what becomes harder now is to deliver such like the care that we're delivering at scale. We're having to learn every week around the inefficiencies that exist and then how we try and fit around that. Staying to our principles of being data-driven, being agile, being like, okay, here's one problem. Is this cropping up in other places? Versus being like, I'll just make a quick fix on this problem. Like, I'll solve this. It's really hard because we now have 16 employees and 37 counselors, and we're all at max capacity. So I don't have as much space to encourage my team to spend the time to think about the long term versus the day-to-day. And I think we all struggle with that as an ongoing challenge. Whereas in the private sector, chuck me a strategy day here, a long meeting there. And now I'm like, where do I get time for that? You know, how do we do that? Because it's hard to really carve out the time to do that. I would say that is my biggest challenge at the moment. I could probably list off more.
Before, you were talking about clients and customer service, but those were paying clients and customers. Whereas now, obviously, some people like contribute for their counselling sessions, but broadly, the counselling is free at a point of use that Suicide and Care provide. And it's all, like everything you're doing is operating on money that's been donated, whether through grant or other sorts of fundraising, right? So the idea that you'd have a strategy day here and strategy day there is harder to pull, because like I sense that you feel an obligation. Well, there is an obligation that all of those funds raised are put to good use, right? Which maybe is slightly different than if you're working in a corporate environment, perhaps.
But this is the thing, and I agree, but this is the thing. And the definition of like funds going to good use is fascinating in the charity world, because I think often the general public would look at charities being like, you know, thinking of aid workers or nurses in physical locations or vets with dogs. You know, they can really see like care being given. And it's the same with our counsellors and our suicide bereavement advisors. They get that, but they don't get the admin person that has to sit and be paid to figure out where all of these people are going to sit and what are they going to use for their laptops and how are we going to have lighting in a space that feels safe for them. Like the time that I think is around the day-to-day delivery is often looked at like it should be on the thinnest budget. Like if you're going on a train, you should be sat on the roof, just like carrying your bag with you. Don't have a seat. But the reality is, like the time for long-term thinking, the time for strategy, the time to think, should we analyze whether this problem is coming up so that we actually save ourselves time in the future, is hugely important. And it's something that we do a lot of. I think it's something our funders really appreciate. And when you explain to a big donor, this is only making us more efficient, they completely get it. But I think it's just remembering that and really staying true to that and valuing it when we are so busy in the day to day.
So you've been on both sides of the fence. You've been on the corporate side. Now you're running this phenomenal charity. What do you see, having been on the corporate side, where you'd have had a CSR strategy, you'd have done volunteer days, to now running a charity? What's the if there was a business that wanted to really engage with Suicide & Co. or a charity in general, what advice would you have them for? I guess going back to the point about fundraising, how can someone have the biggest impact for the investment they're making?
Yeah, it's really interesting because I think CSR as a space, corporate social responsibility, has changed so dramatically. You know, I think if we think about the last like 5 to 10 years, it used to be novel for a brand, let's just say a consumer product, to say that they were giving 10% of their profit to charity. That's now like, if you're not giving to charity or planting a tree, should you even be existing? Every brand is doing that. But genuinely 10 years ago, that was a bit of a novelty. You know, then in the corporate world, the B2B businesses, your CEO probably had a budget of 20K. And if he knew someone's friend of a friend or whatever, he'd chuck him a 20K check. Sometimes I wish it was still like that. But, you know, the reality is both of those spaces have really matured. Now, I would still say sometimes it feels like navigating the Wild West. And every time we meet a new organization, we just have to ask, what are you doing? Because it's so vastly different. Most organizations will have a budget. Some of the budgets are dictated by leadership. Some are structured in grant programs. Some are employee empowered. Some of those budgets sit within HR. Some of them sit within CSR, and some of them sit within ESG. I would say that company matching schemes have become very popular. So if somebody's running a marathon, they raise 800 quid, the company will match it. And then, you know, things like payroll giving are also underutilized, and there's charity volunteering days. Now, there's a huge number of ways to tax efficiently, but also, you know, employee benefit wise, get involved in charity. I think it's incredibly important that people do. I personally think it's worth the organization first thinking, what are we going to do? Like, what area are we going to focus on? Are we going to work with pro bono clients? Are we going to work with employee voted charities? Or are we going to decide, because we work in cars, we're going to work on the environment? So have a really clear like stance on it. And I also think that they need leadership buy-in. I think when you have an employee group who've all volunteered and come together and decided what they're going to do, you need a leadership stakeholder for it to get real traction and for them to have budgets to be effective. And I then think it's about really setting out what you want to achieve and then identifying charities that you think you'd work with well, and then respecting that they also have a ton of stuff that they're doing. Because what I think now is some of the people who have structured corporate giving programs, they've structured it to try and make sure they're fair and to try and make sure that they can be inclusive and all of this stuff, which is fantastic. But they've made the process of applying for it incredibly time consuming for the charities. And so you've then got charities who you're trying really hard to give a $2,000 amount of money, and you're making them spend, I don't know, let's say 4 or 5 hours of senior resource working on that application for potentially a 2% success rate. That doesn't sound like the right way we should be doing things. And I think there's a huge amount of work that needs to happen in both the corporate giving space and the philanthropic space in grants and foundations. And there are people working on it, of how does this system work in this modern day? I mean, the system's been going for centuries of giving in this way. Like, how do we try and structure it so that it is fair and balanced?
If you're running a business with, say, 40 or 50 people, you've not got a director. There's not someone whose role it will be looking after your charitable giving, for example. What advice, one or two things would you encourage those businesses to focus on to frankly make the biggest impact with the charity?
Say, identify a leadership stakeholder and an employee stakeholder and go straight to the top and ask where you can get money from. And once you figure out how much you've got, that will depend on what you should do with it.
So you've got a budget, you've got a pot, you decide you're going to spend X, whether that's percentage of revenue, percentage of profits, or whatever it is. What should they then do? Go and speak to the charity, or
they should then
white suicide and co check?
It really is about, I mean, each, I know this isn't a helpful answer, but each organization is going to be different. It's about understanding, like, what is the goal you want to achieve, and then trying to figure out the best way to give. Like, there are, you know, organizations helping businesses do this. But I think understanding the budget, the goal, and then trying to think about the best way to get that across charities, I think, is really important. I also think that, you know, essentially organizations have the ability to corral a population of people. And that's why doing things like awareness trainings are fab, but also encouraging them to do things like fundraising. If you have a charity of the year partner, encouraging them to do charity corporate volunteering days. It is mind-blowing to me how many go by the wayside. Like, any organization that is offering charity volunteering days, they are seeing so little of them used, right? And the reality is, I don't think that employees realize that they're being paid to volunteer. Like, if you don't take them, you're choosing to work instead of choosing to volunteer. And you're actually being paid to volunteer, so you're not actually volunteering. It's like choosing not to go on holiday. Now, I know there are some people that do choose not to go on holiday, but I genuinely just don't think people have got in their heads what they could be doing. And I think that the charity sector is also, people think they are going to go and work in a soup kitchen or build a community garden. People need to get a bit clever of, like, how we use them. So, you know, for our ball, for example, we have like 25 people taking, you know, corporate volunteering days so that they can help us on the night, provide the most amazing experience for our guests.
You've done well with the charity is actually to, like, leverage expertise as well. So it's not just people coming along to work in a soup kitchen. You're actually using marketeers or lawyers or accountants or whoever to leverage their expertise. Why not?
I think here's another thing. I mean, like, we've worked with WOW ever since we started as a pro bono client. And I would say that we have our relationship with WOW and two other relationships where we're a pro bono client, but my God, do we not feel like we are. And if you can actually, as an organization, have a pro bono client and treat them like a real one, I think you are an incredible organization. And I think if you have to restrict it to one client a year, restrict it, but do it properly, because the number, and I'm talking about our design agency, Doozy, and I'm talking about our legal firm, Slaughter & May, and WOW. I mean, they are three incredible brands that I speak about whenever I get an opportunity to rate them, because as a pro bono client, we are treated like a normal client. Now, we're very low maintenance because we don't want to be too high maintenance. We're also respectful of their time. But if you need them, and if in, you know, the day to day, you wouldn't even know we weren't paying for the service. And the opposite of that is, like, yes, I see it's a favor still. But when you get given a favor and somebody says, I want to take you on as a pro bono client, but the dial keeps moving, when you need something that you put behind the real paying clients, you know, you might as well have gone and paid for it somewhere else, because actually you are not getting the service that you need as an organization. And I really, really believe in that. I believe in people doing pro bono in the right way. Don't only do it for a case study, really do it in the right way. I think it's fantastic when you do. And I hope to continue to like repay all the partnerships that we have and stay with them because of how generous they've been.
Part of my motivation for working with you guys was that when we had a Bremen at WOW, there was no support. I didn't know where to go to. I was completely lost. And fortunately now there's a lot more support. But from your perspective, not just from a suicide and care perspective, but generally, what advice would you give business owners? Certainly, before you talked about that first week, what's the playbook? What are the two or three things that you'd advise people to do?
Well, I think for any business leader listening to the podcast, that'd be amazing. It would be amazing to hear. I wish I could hear them vote now, but you know, I'd be surprised to hear how many people actually in a leadership position are aware of what their bereavement policy is. You know, if we just start at a macro level, there is no statutory bereavement leave for people who are having lost someone over the age of 18. And so if you lose a family member to suicide, let's say you're a 21-year-old and you lose a 25-year-old brother, you know, you are technically allowed 2 days off, which is ridiculous if you're working in an industry like construction and you're operating heavy machinery. Everyone can see how unsafe that is. Now, the reality is in most urban cities, in big organizations, they would have flexibility within compassionate leave, but no structures are there, no processes are there, nothing is to fall back on. And all it takes is one bad manager or not compassionate leadership member, and you've got somebody really facing the worst moment of their life with very little support. So I think my advice to businesses would be to really look at the policy and use an example, use a human example, and think, does this actually fit our organization, or do we need to change it and move to ideally enhanced bereavement leave? And we'd also like to see the government move to 2 weeks statutory leave for any bereavement. I would then say that really bringing it up with the HR team and going, how confident do we feel in navigating topics of grief and suicide in the workplace? You know, as an example, Mental Health First Aid England course doesn't cover grief, and yet it covers eating disorders and psychosis and things like that. And there's like half a page on suicide. I do tons of talks with businesses specifically around suicide and grief and suicide loss, kind of the three for the price of one. And I've always heard that people have said that they've never had these conversations happen before. And then I would, in the case of, you know, scenario modeling, what we would do if we lost a colleague to suicide, or if a colleague, you know, went off on compassionate leave, having lost a close family member or friend to suicide. I think it's worth scenario modeling, like how would we deal with it? How would we communicate with it? There's new guidance being released. But so those would be my three things. But my biggest piece of advice is, if you find yourself in this situation, reach out to Suicide & Co. Because we have gone through in our 5-year journey structures and platforms and, you know, all these different ways that we could serve businesses. But ultimately, what we found is we were looking at businesses like they were suddenly a one size fit all. And the reality is, it's just like our clients. They're not. Every situation is completely different. Was the colleague well known? Was the colleague, you know, there's so many different things that affect the support that an organization needs. But hear me loud and clear, the support is needed and is fully deserved. And colleagues as a population of people who are impacted by a death often don't feel worthy. They often don't feel like, gosh, you know, of course the parents or the siblings deserve support. I don't need counseling. But actually, you could have had a conversation with the colleague the week before and think to yourself, gosh, did I notice something? Should I have said something? And even those moments there deserve to be aired. They deserve to be spoken about and validated. And you know, we can do that.
What's your view of the future for Suicide & Co?
I think it probably goes back to that North Star. I'd like to see us contribute to, you know, a better world in suicide bereavement, where somebody who is having their lives shattered by suicide loss today is, you know, immediately feeling like they deserve support and that support is out there through us, ideally. But that that really is what the future that I want to build. I don't know whether we're still in the startup phase or when we're with the scale up phase, but I feel like we're kind of changing every month how fast we're growing. And so I think in our future, I see a lot of growth. I see a lot of need to hold hands with organizations, with funders, with big strategic partners to help us get there. But I ultimately see the future as somewhere really exciting. I think it's rare in the charity space to be working in an area where you have the ability to create systemic change. And we really have that ability. There is currently a system where the referral places aren't in place and too many people are suffering in silence by suicide loss in a system that isn't working. We absolutely have the ability to change that. We know 80% of the solution, you know, and we want to work with people to get there.
And what does that mean in practice for, like, in practical terms for you and for the charity?
I think it means expanding our current one-to-one services to a point where everybody could access them with the similar wait list and growing the team.
So that's scaling up the number of counsellors?
Yeah, number of counsellors, number of team, and what we're able to do.
And therefore the funding, fundraising?
Yes, yeah. Well, I mean, as you said earlier, like, it's like sometimes it feels like having two separate businesses because they don't necessarily talk to each other. I mean, a lot of our clients support us afterwards, which is absolutely incredible. But, you know, we have two different client bases. We have people donating so that people can have counseling versus somebody buying a product and consuming that product. So I think the reality is, yeah, the fundraising bit is the bit that really, you know, I have less visibility on because it's incredibly challenging to think, gosh, if we're going to get to the point where, you know, we were serving 36,000 people a year, you know, in real, you know, napkin maths, that's like £30 million we need a year. You know, that's a huge, huge change. I mean, it's still only half the income that, you know, an animal welfare charity like Save the Donkeys is raising, but it's still a huge amount. And if you put that into context, I find that quite motivating. You know, could we get to the point where we were half the size of a charity like that? Huge ambition, but
so,
you know,
Save the Donkeys raises how much per year?
I think it's about £57 million a year, which is a huge amount and a hugely worthy cause. Even if you think of Cats, the charity, it raises like £200 million.
When you think the future, like, you and I have been working together for over 4 years now, and the number of times that you've come to me and said, oh, I'm going to do this thing. And I'll say to you, Amelia, you know that's crazy, don't you? And then you go ahead and do it anyway. And then I'm like, oh, wow, I thought that was crazy. And then you come back with something else that's even more crazy. And I've just got to the point that I just kind of like nod and think, well, do you know what? You're probably going to do it. If you knew you couldn't fail, what would you do next?
That's a fantastic question. Oof, if I knew I couldn't fail. I mean, the thing is that I have such a step-by-step road of how I can see scaling the service. But I guess the big scary thing, if we're being honest, would be in-person delivery. All of our current counselling is online and via telephone, which I think is going to be the future. And I think it would continue to be the future of the mass of our model. But I would love the opportunity to pilot doing in-person day retreats and having a space where my client team worked, where there was also delivery in that space. And that model is terrifying because it's expensive, it's real estate, it's all of that type of thing. So if I knew I couldn't fail, that is what I would definitely trial because it's the biggest, it's the riskiest one. I think a separate question in terms of, like, if I turned it slightly on its head, if I found a patron that was going to give us £1 million a year, I would immediately invest in the service team to bring the waitlist down. Be this my first thing, you know, like that, and probably also improving our app and trying to build some of the features we have in our development pipeline, because I do believe in the fact that if you kind of can do both, like keep that human connection, but also allow for like technology to democratize some of the support we're offering, I just think it's double whammy, mega.
You obviously started with this dream, this vision. Anyone like listening to our conversation today will know, can see that ambition. But on a human level, how do you keep those fires of ambition burnt?
It's never been a struggle to keep the fires of ambition going, because I genuinely feel so passionate about what I'm doing, the work, the community I'm working on behalf of, the problems I'm trying to solve, the solutions we have that are evidence-based. My passion and ambition for that probably is just very intense. I think what I find difficult on a human level is monitoring that and actually ensuring that that doesn't burn me out, that doesn't, you know, mean I don't see anyone, that doesn't, you know, turn into a place where my stress levels are totally one and the same and I don't feel good enough if our wait list goes over 2.5 months or something. That is the thing that's an ongoing journey. I think I have friends like you, I have advisors who help me, who give me kind of new learnings. But to be honest with you, I feel like a student in a classroom pretty much every day with how I continue to monitor that, because I love learning new techniques that could help me. I love buying a new journal that has a different structure to see if that would work. But it's kind of similar to what we were talking about earlier. Balancing time for that and trying to stay aware of the behaviors you're developing and the coping strategies you're using whilst doing it and being busy, I think is very hard. To be honest with you, I had a period of burnout about a year after I started the charity, and I was signed off work for 2 weeks. I was still at my day job. And that was a big shock because I felt like an imposter. I felt like a phony that I'd started a mental health charity, and I myself was having a burnout phase and poor mental health. And I think that experience, not that, you know, I'd ever say somebody should burn out to know how not to burn out, but that experience, I think, made me realize where some of my boundaries are and what some of my warning signs are. But it's a constant battle, to be honest, because I think if you're incredibly passionate about something, if you love what you do, you know, time is a very difficult commodity to put a value on.
Balance. I don't necessarily like the word balance, but you know, when things get out of balance, I suppose. Like, what's the impact beyond just you personally?
I think now it can go out to the whole team, to be honest, because I think, you know, as a leader, I want to be secure for my team. I want to be able to make decisions in the tough times. I want to be able to give them the time to hear what they need and, you know, provide them with direction and uplifting and, you know, motivation and an understanding of how it fits into the broader picture. And ultimately, when I get tired, when I get stressed, when I'm not looking after myself, I cannot do that as well. And I think I constantly kind of come up against that battle, really. And the reality is, when it was a team of me and one, the impact was pretty low. It was just on myself. I think the thing that is the motivator for me to kind of keep working on myself and my personal development is the team, because I don't like being a blocker on work. I don't like being somewhere where they don't have clarity of the direction of travel. You know, I love the team. We've set an incredible culture. We're all so motivated to deliver for our community. But there is the whole logistics of just running a team and an organization and a strategy. And I think my mental health and my ability to do that, directly links to everything like self-care and how I take care of myself.
And is there anyone that you look up to on that level, or any sort of like inspiration or?
I think it varies, to be honest. I think I have personal advisors. I love the concept of like a personal board that I was once told in another company about trying to find people who you have respect for in different areas for different things, or people that you'd go to advice for specific issues, like it could be finance versus marketing or whatever. And I think I'm somebody that I love learning and being inspired by people really close to me. So that's definitely like, you're one of those people for me, for sure. I don't think, I read so many business books, it's actually a bit embarrassing, but like, it depends. I kind of have somebody who I'm obsessed with for a little bit, and then I'll kind of find a new person. I'm super inspired by Dan Pilota, really inspired by Brené Brown, used to be incredibly inspired by Helena Morrissey, recently inspired by Joanna Jensen. you know, I kind of am constantly looking for people that sort of tweak something that will make me think a bit differently and think about how I could do something better.
We always end our interviews with a couple of questions. So firstly, what does beautiful business mean for you?
I think beautiful business for me means a business with a really clear, actionable purpose for a community that's defined.
What advice would you have for people building beautiful businesses?
I would say that if you are wanting to build a beautiful business, if it's a new business, if you are not doing it in the evenings, in the mornings, thinking about it on the tube, wanting to find every data point to prove that you should do it, then you shouldn't be doing it. Like, I think I always hear people talk about ideas, but I mean, I spent hours of like my life trying to find a reason, trying to figure out whether it was the right thing to do, Suicide & Co., which really proved that when we got there, the concept was right. And all of the graft that it takes to get to the point of doing something is so worth it, in my opinion. And it will show you, if you can be there in the boring, you can be there in the beautiful.
That has to be the quote. If you can be there in the boring, you can be there in the beautiful. And I think I vaguely remember you saying to me before that before you started the charity, you spent ages and ages and ages trying to find reasons not to do it.
I was just like, I cannot, I'm not going to do this whole thing, go into it to then realize I didn't need to do it. Right? Like that would be my just like, I was enjoying my corporate career. You know, I would have a big warning for anybody who thinks that they want to join the not-for-profit sector and the philanthropy sector. Like, you get absolutely obsessed and entrenched with working for a real purpose. Like, it's incredible. And it will make you not want to go back into a corporate world. But obviously, for very good reasons, the benefits, all the nice shiny stuff about working doesn't exist in the not-for-profit sector. So you are sacrificing all of that for working much closer to something. And I think businesses that have a lovely, happy medium, perfect. Maybe I'll join one of those one day.
Do you have any regrets about doing what you've done?
Absolutely not. I have little things that I would probably look back on and think, gosh, I wish I hadn't spent so much time on that project because it didn't come to fruition or it didn't have the impact. But I am so proud of the whole team. I'm so proud of the impact we've created, delivering over 20,000 hours of support through counseling and casework and supporting over 3,000 people. I'm so proud. I couldn't have any regrets. It's only been 5 years.
So Amelia, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. I hope that everyone listening has got like a little window into you and into the charity. If they want to find out more, go to the Suicide & Co. website. Loads of ways to support a really, really great, fast-growing charity serving a community much in need of its services. So anyway, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. You're the best.
Thank you for listening to the Beautiful Business Podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, then please remember to subscribe and leave us a review. For more advice and practical tips on what it's really like to build a beautiful business, visit our content hub at wowco.uk/hub or check out the link in the show notes.